Warning, you are about to enter a world populated by the most appalling music ever made. Welcome to the search for the worst album of all time. This is Broken Records.
But I'd been forgotten, I'd been married a long time ago.
Same thing, girl.
A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
You're beautiful.
Hey, I wanna be a rock star.
Hello, welcome to episode number 28 of Broken Records, the podcast which goes out of its way to listen to shit music. Why would they do that? Why? You have to ask yourself why you do that. Just because it's entertaining for you, we hope. My name's Stephen Hill, and his name is Renfrey Deadman. Renfrey, hello.
Hello.
Going down Renfrey's specialist subject today, Pink Floyd's Umaguma is going to be the album that we're talking about. You know, yeah. The band, only the band that Muse could have been.
It's a shame that they never got their due, Pink Floyd, isn't it? I mean, you know, playing bars and stuff like that. You've probably not even heard of them, but hey.
If you don't know what we're talking about, Renfrey thinks that Pink Floyd aren't. He didn't realise Pink Floyd were like big. And he pointed that out on a classic album special about Pink Floyd as well.
I mean, you're definitely making it look worse than it actually is. I didn't realise they were as big as they were. I didn't realise they were
right,
a stadium.
You thought Muse were bigger than them?
Yeah,
you did. You said, oh, you know, Muse have taken on, they've got bigger, more commercially successful. And I was like, what? I believe that was what you said, wasn't it?
Oh, it was along those lines. Yeah, it was something like that.
It was very funny. Anyway, look, we try and find the worst album ever made here on the show. This is part of the Riot Act podcast network. Renfrey and I, every Friday, we do Riot Act, which is a kind of review show where we review the very best in alternative music coming out that week. We also have a Patreon page, patreon.com/RiotActPodcast. You can sign up for that. £5 a month will get you our classic album series podcast. I did The Wall, and that's where Renfrey introduced me to this idea about Pink Floyd not being as sizable as Muse. And which is just something that I know really annoys him, which is why I bring it up every single time Pink Floyd ever come up. And I will for the rest of my dying days. I will do that. Anyway, so basically we used to do a little segment at the end of Riot Act just to sort of tie the show together called Broken Records, where we did what we're doing in this podcast. We decided to make it its very own thing. So what you're about to listen to is the last one of the archived versions of Broken Records, where it was just a part of Riot Act. From now on, going forward, from episode 29, they will be their own thing, properly recorded, new from now going onwards. So I hope so you won't have to suffer any of these shit intros anymore. That's what I'm saying, really. This came out on the 18th of September 2020, Riot Act episode 111. A very good week that was. It was Napalm Death, Bob Mould, Jamie Lenman.
Yeah, brilliant.
Fawn Limbs, Hidden Mothers, pretty good.
Yeah,
it was good. And we spoke about Umaguma as well. Umaguma is, well, this is the thing. So we haven't actually picked these records that are going into Broken Records just because we think they're shit, because I love Pink Floyd. And a lot of people do like this album. This is a very odd one, because I always say, you know, like, it could be the critical response, it could be the commercial response, it could be this, it could be that, it could be the band response. This is one of the few times where it's actually the band's response to their own record is pretty much the main reason why it's here at all. So, you know,
I would say they have a
point. Yeah, I know you would. Yeah, I know you would. I'm not quite as strong on it as Renfrey is, but, you know, I think there's levels to this, is what I'm saying. Anyway, let's all find out exactly what we're talking about. We're going to throw over to ourselves now, talking about Umaguma by Pink Floyd. All right, let's move on and close the show, as we do, with Broken Records. Shall I do a rundown of where we are in Broken Records, or do you think that's not worth it?
This is so many now.
No. So many, isn't it? Fine, fuck it. Okay. Pink Floyd, Umaguma, is what we're going to be talking about this week. Released on the 7th of November 1969, the fourth album by Pink Floyd, the 1960s Muse ripoffs. This is the first Pink Floyd album that contains no new songwriting credits from the band's original leader, Syd Barrett, who left halfway through the making of A Saucer Full of Secrets in 1968, and in came Mr. Dave Gilmour of Standing on Top of the Wall doing a solo fame.
I'm already enjoying this one.
Yeah. So really, you know, I guess this really marks the first time that we get an album entirely made from the quote unquote classic Pink Floyd lineup that made Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, Et Al.
It's a shame, isn't it? Sorry.
What do you mean?
Well, it's a shame that it was this one. Oh, he's taking a sip of his drink.
I'm taking a sip of my drink. That was all. I was just taking a sip of my drink.
I was reading too much so, into that, wasn't I? Yeah, okay, go on.
Yeah, so Umaguma, well, we should just, I guess, just get straight into what it is. The first half of it consists of a live album recorded at Manchester College of Commerce. Yes, really. And a club in Birmingham called Mothers. So it's four tracks. Astronomy Domine, the opening song from Piper and the Gates of Dawn, which is the debut Pink Floyd album. And it's the only writing credit on this album that Syd Barrett has. Obviously, I'm not really counting it because it's a live version of that song. Two from Saucer Full of Secrets and Careful With That Axe, Eugene, which was the B-side to the single Point Me at the Sky, which is quite a rare Floyd single, Renfrew, if you don't know. Whilst the second half of the record is a contribution from each member doing a sort of solo thing. Some of it's quite wacky, as you might imagine. from the time
I think some of this might have been influenced by drugs. I'm gonna put it out there now, I think acid may have had a part to play in this record potentially. Yes.
it's possible the Nick Mason's part featured his then wife Lindy playing flute.
Yeah.
It's exciting, isn't it? Getting your wife in. That normally works well in albums, isn't it? It's always going to work out well, I think, when your wife's in the studio with you, helping you out. I can't think of any time when that's ever been a good idea. Has that ever worked out well? I suppose.
Wings?
I was thinking of Paul McCartney.
No, Wings. I don't know. No, I'm struggling to think. Do tweet us if you can think of anything, but I can't off the top of my head.
Unless you're husband and wife and you're in the band together and that is part of the band.
Yeah, yeah.
But just being like, hey guys, my wife's here. She's going to come and
play the flute.
Really? Actually, I've got one. The Knife Party by Deftones. That's that bit in the middle, the bit that ironically is a massive ripoff of The Great Gig in the Sky.
Yeah.
That's Abe Cunningham's wife.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Oh, fascinating.
I believe. Do you know what? I've just plucked that out of the air from nowhere. I'm 99.9% that is true.
Oh, great.
If it's not...
I'm going to have to fact check that now.
No, don't... Well, no, I'm saying it. I'm almost certain that that's Abe Cunningham.
That's part of what I do in the edit. I fact check. That's why it takes me fucking ages, Steve.
Yeah, but I'm not asking you to fact check it. I'm saying I think that's right. Other people can fact check it and they can go... Actually, no.
But then they'll shout at us, and I don't like it when that
happens. But I've just covered our ass by going, anyway, look, I am so sure. Do you know, I'm so sure I'm right. But as I said it, I went, when was the last time I actually read that or heard that? But I'm sure I'm right. Positive.
Let's go with that you're right, and that's fascinating. And crikey, she's got a set of pipes on her.
She has. Yes, she absolutely has. But for the most part, really, really, I don't think you need to get your wife involved in helping you make your albums, or your maybe husband's.
Or your husband.
So it's pretty wacky, as you might imagine, for Pink Floyd at this time. But the amount of work that they put in individually to their own little contributions to this record and that live thing was kind of enough to justify the first post Syd Barrett Pink Floyd album, which, on reflection, to me, I think we'll probably talk about this in a bit, doesn't really feel like a lot of thought has gone into this record, particularly in terms of this should be some sort of, we are the new, this is Pink Floyd now, this is the statement. Not, here's a live album and we've done a song each as well.
Well, I feel like a lot of drugs have gone into it. Maybe we should say allegedly.
Definitely a lot of drugs went into it. Absolutely. Like, there's no fucking getting away from that. That happened. There was a lot of drugs involved. But just as a business, not as a business decision, but as a creative decision, and as putting a marker down.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a dumb fucking move. It's a dumb fucking move.
Silly.
Dumb move.
But anyway, so, I mean, it went in, as the album was released, went to number 5 in the UK charts, and it was number 74 in the US Billboard charts, their first album to chart that high in the US. It's currently sold over 1 million copies in the USA. That's platinum. It's gone gold here in the UK, 60,000 copies. At the time of release, critics were fairly positive to this record. The International, I don't actually know what that is, but it was a thing from the time, called it probably one of the best live recordings I've ever heard. Robert Christgau has suggested that the album's hypnotic melodies make it an admirable record to fall asleep to. I'm not sure if that's... I'm not sure. I mean...
He's a prick, isn't he?
He is a bit of a prick, but I mean...
I mean, I do agree with him, but he is a prick.
I mean, much like when we do any of these albums from this period of time, it's actually really quite hard to find reviews from that period.
Yes.
So there aren't really many reviews for me to be able to call on, unfortunately. But when Pink Floyd re-released their entire back catalogue over the many times that they have done that, the re-releases, when they've come out there, the sort of reviews at that point... appear to have been quite a mixed bag of opinions. Stylist magazine was very positive about it in 2012. They said, as a visceral document of the early Floyd's proclivity for atmospheric, energetic jamming, there's nothing else like it. They also said that the studio half of it somehow transcends its fractured construction to make a full-length statement. The Daily Telegraph gave it 3 out of 5 when they reviewed the entire Pink Floyd discography in 2012. The Rolling Stone album guide has given it 2.5 out of 5, not terrible. Sputnik Music gave it 4 out of 5, saying, in the end, Umaguma, within its essence, is an exploratory odyssey, one in which Pink Floyd discover new musical realms and take themselves to even stranger dimensions. This is certainly one of their least appreciated efforts, and far from being a classic, but it was a necessary step in their career. So it sold well. It's been reviewed quite well. It's not really seen as one of the best in their back catalogue, but certainly not the worst either. So for one of the first times in Broken Records history, Renfrey, I'm going, well, why is it here? Sold 1 million copies in America. Big hit. They got big off the back of it. The critics seem to quite like it. I've been looking at the fan sites. You get a lot of good reviews from the fan sites. People seem to like it. Why is this in Broken Records? We even had a few tweets from people going, oh my God, are you mad? It's great. People, it's probably the most we've ever had for an album that was going into this list on Broken Records.
Yes.
So the only thing I can think is, why is it here? Well, this is a little bit like Stanley Kubrick banning A Clockwork Orange. Everyone else seems to like it, but the band themselves think it's fucking rubbish. Roger Waters has called it a disaster. Dave Gilmour was asked what he thinks of either side in an interview back in 1994. He said, I think both are horrible. The live disc of Umaguma might be all right, but even that isn't recorded well. Nick Mason has said, this is absolutely not a band album. The live stuff sounds incredibly antiquated, although the fact that Pink Floyd playing at Mother's in Birmingham was considered a bit of an event at the time. We were looking for new ways of constructing an album, although I think this demonstrates... what this demonstrates is that our sum is always better than the parts. EMI was very hidebound in those days. It was run by guys in white coats. I was prevented from editing my own tapes by a studio manager who told me I wasn't a union member. Dave Gilmour said, I'd never written anything before. I just went up into the studio and started waffling about, tacking bits and pieces together. I rang up Roger at one point to ask him to write some lyrics for me. He just said, no. Nick Mason also said, I thought it was a very good and interesting little exercise, the whole business of everyone doing a bit, but I still feel really strongly that it's quite a good example of the sum being greater than the parts. The most significant thing is that we didn't do it again. So Pink Floyd themselves think this is shit, basically. Mm-hmm. And I guess that is why it gets onto lists of, you know, when you talk about the worst album ever or the most this and that album ever, Umma Gumma gets on there because Pink Floyd themselves are like, oh, God, and they're always slagging it off. Renfrey, are they right to slag this record off?
I think they're absolutely 100% right to slag this record off.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's fucking dreadful. personally.
fucking hell.
I listen to this and I understand why the punk movement rose up in such great opposition against prog, generally.
Yeah,
you know, because this is...
I mean, let's be clear here. Mm. This is more psychedelic, 60s psychedelia than it is prog, I would say.
Yes, but yes, fine. Well, it's psychedelic prog, isn't it? I mean, we're splitting hairs here. We're splitting hairs here. But you know, like, it's... One thing that it undeniably is very self-indulgent. Okay. You said to me, you listened to this before me, and you gave me a little bit of a pre-warning heads up, which I very much appreciated. I think you could have spent 24 hours warning me about this record and I still wouldn't have got the enormity of the utter shitness of it. you said that the live album was okay, was, you know, all right. But the studio album is where it really descends into broken record territory.
Yeah.
And I think that's fair to an extent. But I have to say, even the live album, and I'm not familiar with, or in fact, I'm not familiar with any of the songs except for A Saucer Full of Secrets, which is by far for me the best track on the entire thing. By far.
Really? Okay.
For my money. Yeah. But when I hear a song like Astronomy Domine, mm-hmm. The way that it rises and falls and tries to go to different places and be dynamic and all that sort of thing, but it's 8.5 minutes and it never actually feels like it goes anywhere, you know. And I think, I mean, I do feel like I'm returning to an argument which I've made before, but people say that post-rock is self-indulgent. Post-rock is Blink-182 compared to this. Oh, that's a bad example. But in terms of its non-self-indulgence.
Yeah, I agree.
But, you know, it's like, this is so self-indulgent. It's just unbelievable. I mean, this is the stuff that I recall. When we were doing the Wall special, brought up a friend of mine from drama school who was obsessed with the Syd Barrett era of Pink Floyd, and he used to play me this stuff all the time, and I was just like, I don't get it, man. And here I find myself almost 17-18 years later, and I'm still in, I do not get this stuff at all. I find it really boring, really dull, really droll, and overlong, overstuffed, self-indulgent. And to add to that, the other big argument I always make with Pink Floyd, other bands have come along and done this stuff better. This whole thing of like, oh, they're the originators, so therefore they're the best. That whole argument, you know, Black Sabbath are not the best metal band ever. The MC5 are not the best punk band ever, if we're going to call them a
Black
punk band.
Black Sabbath are very, 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 very high up in the list of the best metal bands ever.
They're very good, but they're not the best. DJ Kool Herc is not the best hip hop artist of all time. You know, this whole thing of the originator is the best. It's just nonsense. I mean, careful with that Axe Eugene. Certainly sounds very reminiscent of the Mars Volta. And I'm sure
I was going to say for the live thing, I think Careful with that Axe Eugene is the best. I think it's the best thing. It's probably my favorite bit on the record, actually.
Okay. I will say, like, I listened to that and I was like, okay, the Mars Volta were definitely paying attention to this song. Like, I'd be really surprised if they hadn't heard this song. And there's bits on it which reminded me of Francis the Mute. You know, certainly the really, really, really long song that's like 35 minutes spread over a few tracks, mm-hmm. particularly. But, you know, I think the Mars Volta have advanced it and made it far better and made it far more exciting and made it far more, put a lot more kind of verve and spirit and energy into it. And I just, I think if you compare the two, it's just, it's night and day, personally. I think careful with that Axe Eugene. It's borderline. Yeah. Okay, it's one of the better moments on the record. I don't think it's saying a lot, especially when we get to disc two. But it probably is. I think if you told me when I came to it, because it's the second track, isn't it? I think if you told me that this was going to be one of the best songs on the record, I would have just given up at that point. Because, I mean, yeah, we'll get onto the second disc in a moment, which I'm sure you will agree with me on a lot of that stuff. But even the live album, whilst there were bits that I really liked, and actually a Saucerful of Secrets is one of them, I did think this is self-indulgent twaddle, and this is everything I hate about Pink Floyd.
Yes, I mean, you know, Pink Floyd at this point, I think are very, very definitely, you know, doing the Syd Barrett mad, psychedelic, elongated, whatever fucking, you know, and also Wank. You know, yeah, I mean, look, you know, I said this when we did The Wall, I'm not someone who is in love with, I mean, we'll talk about sort of where they went and stuff in a little bit, there are bits from the Syd Barrett era. I mean, I've got Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and I think some of it's really fucking good, of it's really good, right? And Syd Barrett is obviously a very single-minded and unique individual.
I will say, just to interject very quickly, Piper at the Gates of Dawn is actually on Writer's Review, so we will do that one day.
Yeah, we will. I won't make you listen to too much more Pink Floyd for a while. not
for a while, but we will do it, yeah, one day.
Yeah, you know, but I don't think that I think the live, you know, there's bits of the Syd Barrett era that I like. There's bits that I think is everything that you've just said.
Yeah.
And there's kind of the direct aftermath of the Syd Barrett era as well at this point. I mean, the whole idea of the album just smacks. I mean, I said at the start, like, who's in charge here? And this whole album feels like, who's running this show now? Mm-hmm. Like, I think you can listen to Saucerful of Secrets and that is slightly transitory. I think you can listen to Piper at the Gates of Dawn, you go, well, I at least know who's in charge here, or at least somebody has taken the reins here. Yep. Umaguma is a kind of a reinless, directionless record. I don't necessarily think all of it is bad. I mean, like I say, those songs were not created in the studio for the live tracks. I think Careful with the Axe Eugene is good. You mentioned the live Saucerful of Secrets, which points of that I'm like, yeah, this is good. It's not a brilliant live album. I think the recorded equals are superior to them. Yes. in every case
certainly a Saucerful of Secrets, I can confirm, definitely it's better on the original.
Yeah. And it's then when, and you're right, it's then when we get to the recorded side, studio album part, where I'm going to give, do you know what, before we kind of go, oh, what are you thinking? I'm going to at least give Roger Waters a little bit of credit for at least attempting to write a song.
Yep, fair.
Like Roger Waters.
Grantchester Meadows.
Yeah, I'm not going to shit on Roger Waters, because I would say actually Grantchester Meadows it's not ever going to be, like, if I'm making a list of the greatest Pink Floyd ever songs ever, that ain't going to be in there. But in the context of this record, when it comes in, I'm like, oh, I think this is a fucking actual song. And Roger Waters is actually trying to write a song. There's stuff Richard Wright.
Well, just to say Grantchester Meadows on that, it's pleasant enough, that song, but it is very much a Stockholm Syndrome thing, isn't it? It is very much like, oh, thank God, something's come in that's melodious and tuneful. I mean, let's not piss about. It's still not a good song, but it is a song, at least.
I think it's an all right song. I think it's a, you know, is it a great? It's not a great song. Is it a good song? It's an all right song. It's an all right song.
It's double the length it needs to be. Seven and a half minutes.
Well, you can say that about a lot of songs. I don't necessarily think it makes them bad songs.
Can you say about a lot of songs that they're double the length they need to be? I don't think you can say about a lot of songs.
It's quite a little bit too. I would say five minutes of this would be fine.
I think 3 minutes of it would have been fine. perfect, actually. It's okay. It's a nice song. It's a nice, pleasant song, but it is very much. I think it's such a sort of after the absolutely dreadful self-indulgent shit that comes before it. I think that's the reason why. I think if you isolated it, then you'd be like, meh.
So who is the most pretentious of the other three? Because I'm gonna tag Roger Waters out here. Yep, I mean, of course I am fucking going on about the wall. Everyone's gonna be like, oh, Hill, you fucking get your tongue out of Roger Waters' bum. But like, I am gonna say Roger Waters, you are exempt from, I mean, apart from not helping Dave Gilmour out with any lyrics, which he clearly needed.
I'm happy to tag him out, but shouldn't we mention the fact that he's responsible for several species of small furry animals gathered together in a cave and grooving with a Pict? That's the name of the song.
Yeah.
So he's responsible for Naughty's emo titles, for starters.
But I find that at least sort of funny.
For 5 minutes?
Well, you know, it's Pink Floyd, isn't it?
If Aylstorm did that, you'd be fucking furious. Is all I'll say.
Well, if Aylstorm did that and they did that 12 times, which is what they tend to do, then yes, I would be furious. At least it's like...
So let's explain what it is. It's a bunch of sort of whooping animal noises and then Waters occasionally, whooping over the top of it, isn't it? For five minutes.
And doing the Scottish, talking in a Scottish accent.
Yeah, for 5 minutes.
I mean, look, it's not great. It's not great, but then...
It's terrible.
You know, it's not great. It's not great, I guess. No, it's not. I like the Scottish accent is nice to listen to. I feel like I'm really struggling to like not slag off Roger Waters.
I'm really sorry, mate, but it's bad. I'm so sorry. Look, I know you love Pink Floyd, and I don't really enjoy tearing them apart because they have influenced some of my favourite bands ever. But it is terrible. It is objectively terrible. Okay, let's move on. Go on.
So who's the worst? Wright, Gilmour or Mason?
For me, it's between Wright and Mason.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Goodness me. Fucking hell. Goodness me.
It's got to be Wright, innit? It's got to be Wright.
I think it is Wright.
Just falling on his keyboard.
Well, goodness me. Okay, so he has written the song Sisyphus, and it's in four separate parts, as Pink Floyd are wont to do. I didn't make notes of part one, but part two is the sound of a cat walking over random keys of a piano. Part three is that same cat walking over different parts of the piano whilst hitting a drum kit and drowning. And part four is that same cat walking over a Moog on heavy sedatives before startling itself by falling on an organ. That's what this song is. And it is fucking shite. It's awful. John Cage would look at this and go, bit avant-garde, lads. It's fucking... just shit. It's shit. I don't understand the cult of Pink Floyd. I just don't get it. I don't understand. I mean, and it is a cult. It's ridiculous because you just kind of get people who go, oh my God, it's genius. They were the first to do it. They were the first to put a cat on a piano. It's like, no, it's fucking shit. What I mean, I know this is not the record to judge them as a whole.
Well, I was
going to
say, don't think that's what people were thinking when they talk about how great. That's not what my head does not go to fucking Sisyphus parts 1 to 4 when I think about why I like Pink Floyd.
No, sure. But you did acknowledge at the beginning of this Broken Records that this wasn't particularly reviewed badly. And I feel like if any other band had released it, it would have had at least a star knocked off of all of the reviews. I mean, I'm looking at some of them now. It should have had several stars knocked off all of them. And I can't help but feel that the only reason that it didn't have those stars knocked off is because it's Pink fucking Floyd. And I just don't get it. I think we do call out other bands when that sort of thing happens. And I think, you know, I mean, maybe I feel like you're part of the cult, Steve. I'm sorry to say it, but I think you might be part of the cult. Yeah, but I looked up the reviews on Amazon for this album, and you know, just people being like, "Oh, it's a masterwork," and all this kind of thing. It's like, what are you fucking on about?
It's dreadful. Like, there are bits that are good, but I reckon this is 86 minutes and 32 seconds in total. I reckon that only 20 minutes of this entire thing has anything that is even vaguely approaching good. And even then, I wouldn't say it's good. It's just vaguely approaching good. And for me, like I say, A Saucer Full of Secrets is the highlight of the entire thing. And the version on the album, which is A Saucer Full of Secrets, isn't it? Yeah, is better. It's just a total pointless waste of time. It's fucking shite.
Well, in their own defense, mm-hmm. this is what Dave Gilmour said when asked about this album in 2011. We were fairly brave and we would put anything on a record that amused us one way or another. Okay. But in some of those moments, we were floundering about and didn't have our forward momentum very clear. And inspiration might have been a bit thin on the ground at times. A bit. I mean, very much so, Dave, yeah. People accuse us of being pretentious, but if you don't push the boundaries, if you don't verge on the borders of pretentious, I don't think you can advance an awful lot. You've got to have the courage and not care what people think about you in that moment. Now, I agree with all of that, right? I think that is why, you know, Pink Floyd, like I said, this is the classic lineup of Pink Floyd, but they'd lost their leader at this point. They'd lost the guy who was the fucking guy. Sid Barrett was the guy who did all the stuff. He was the one that everyone thought about. It would be like Nirvana trying to get a new front man in, or maybe not even that. It would be like, you know, it's like trying to get trying to think of someone like Hetfield. Be trying to get like a replacement for James Hetfield after a couple of albums, and suddenly you're looking around and you're like, oh fuck, like,
but this is the stuff that should remain on the studio floor.
Well, that's fair.
This is I understand that this is a process, and I do get that, like, you know, sometimes you have to come out with all sorts of shit before you get to the gold, you know. But I just don't understand at all. I mean, maybe it was a contractual obligation or something like that that we're not considering or thinking about, or that I'm not considering or thinking about. And certainly that thing that Gilmour said, it was Gilmour that you quoted from there, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. About, I mean, you're not going to get anyone who agrees with that sentiment more than me in terms of, like, in order to be experimental and so on and so forth, you do have to be pretentious. I talk about pretentious music all the fucking time, but there's pretentious music and then there's this is beyond pretentious. This is so far up the arse of stuff. Like, so far up. I mean, you compare it to Mono or We Lost the Sea or anything like that, or Godspeed You Black Emperor even, and this is like, it's extraordinarily pretentious.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the time, 1969.
Sure,
you
sure.
Know, that was
sure.
the time. And in those days, bands released an album every year. You got to think, it was only a year before that Saucer Full of Secrets came out, and the dude who was fucking in charge of everything left halfway through recording that. And then they're like, well, we got to put a new thing out, and they tried this. Now, I mean, even when you get to Atom Heart Mother, which comes out a year later, I mean, even Roger Waters has even slagged that off, saying he'd like to throw that in the dustbin, which I think at least that's an album. Mm. Like, you know, Metal, and then at Metal, I go, ah, yeah, I'm starting to see what this band are. Mm. And then you get Dark Side of the Moon, and then you get arguably one of the best four runs ever. And I understand, like, I, you know, did the world need to hear this? Mm. Not really. But if Pink Floyd having to release this and having to go, okay, well, we can't do that again, if that leads them to the point where they're releasing The Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here and Animals and The Wall, then I can live with this album existing. I don't, you know, if you're like me, you call me that, you know, the cult of Pink Floyd and da, 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 and you say that about, like, oh, you're part of it. I'm not part of it in the sense that you know, like I say, the Sid Barrett stuff, I can kind of take or leave it. There's some of it I think is pretty good. There's some of it that I don't think is really good. I'm not really that into sort of psychedelic 60s psychedelia by anyone. You know, I like the Doors, but even the Doors, when the Doors get
up their own ass. Yeah, yeah, yeah. When they were fucking amazing. But yeah.
But yeah, again, when they're good, but it's not really my bag.
Might have been a bit unfair to say you were part of the cult, but just to give you a few ideas, I did just call up the Amazon thing. I'm not going to actually read the reviews. But the reason I wanted to call up Amazon is these are reviews not by critics, they're reviews by people, you know, by ordinary folk, by civilians, as we call them.
Yeah.
And just to read the headlines of these reviews, always perfection. Classic Pink Floyd sounding better than the original vinyl. Great screams. I fully accept that I'm an old timer, but don't think Floyd have ever done better. That's the cult of Pink Floyd.
Yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. If you're like me and you love the big, big commercial Pink Floyd stuff, and you, when you think of Pink Floyd, you do think of, you know, that run of four. I think you'll find a lot of this incredibly alienating. You just will.
Yeah.
And they certainly made the right choice. And in my mind, you know, the direction they went in, writing songs, for me is clearly, you know, I don't care how fucking much of a, you know, sellout or much of a fucking normie it makes me sound. Comfortably Numb is better than anything that happened at this period.
It is.
And, you know, like, you can tell me that I'm like basic as fuck or whatever. I just think I like actual, you know, songs are great. Not that this has not got any no songs on it at all, and it's completely different, but I think that approach suits them much better. And the reason people talk about Pink Floyd and how great they are now, I don't think is because of stuff like Umma Gumma. Having said that, for doing something that I'm not like super invested in the first half on the live album. But this is not the worst. Like, this is when we come to ranking it here, this is nowhere near the worst that we've done at all.
Oh, definitely not. I don't think. No. I mean, just for the fact that it doesn't have troublesome lyrics, let's say, it doesn't get into the worst. No. I have to admit, I'm looking at the list in front of me, and it is quite difficult to figure out a place for it, I have to admit. But I would say it's somewhere in the middle. I don't think, like, D.D. King, I've got a lot more love for, and yeah, even Shatner and Lauryn Hill, blah, blah, blah. So I certainly don't think it's around there, but it's absolutely not as risible as your Uncle Crackers, your Broken Sides, your Blood on the Dance Floors, your Methods of Mayhem. So really, I think we're looking at somewhere in the middle, maybe somewhere between Queen and Paul Rodgers and Mick Jagger, maybe. I don't know if you have the list up there. So
I do. I mean, I'm just looking at it. There's a little gap here. There's kind of Black and White Rainbows by Bush, Primitive Cool by Mick Jagger, Results May Vary by Limp Bizkit. I mean, I have to say, as soon as I got there, I was like, well, this is better than Results May Vary. It's pretentious as fuck.
You're not going to hear me sticking up for Limp Bizkit very often, but I don't think it is better than Results.
You really think?
Yeah, I do. I can't believe you've made me do it, Steve, and I feel sick in my mouth. But I do think Fred Durst is better than this. I actually do.
At least, you know, the first half of this, they are doing a thing that they try and do and doing it well. I mean, Limp Bizkit aren't even good at doing the thing that then they tried.
I don't think they're doing it well. I just don't think they are.
The live album?
No. I think
they're certainly doing it better than the fucking Limp Bizkit trying to do Nickelback.
I don't think it's done well, though. And I think Limp Bizkit had a couple of moments on it which made me go, oh, at least that's quite a good riff. I suppose this has a couple of moments on it which makes me go, it's a hard one. I mean, to be totally perfectly frank with you, I was kind of looking at it and thinking of putting it kind of, oh, I don't think you're gonna like this, sort of between The Enemy and Dirty Vegas.
Yeah. I mean...
It's not good, Steve. It's
I'm
really
not saying
bad.
It's good. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying that, like, when it's bad, it's fucking dreadful. And it's also,
long. It's really long.
It's really long.
Results
yeah.
may vary as long as well, but, you know.
I mean, they're all bloody long. All these fucking albums are yeah. long, aren't they?
Well, The Enemy's, like, 43 minutes. Dirty Vegas was quite short, from what I recall.
Here would be my kind of my riposte to just particularly Dirty Vegas and The Enemy.
Okay.
You won't forget what's on here. Like The Enemy is like and Dirty Vegas are like bubbles. You blow it and as soon as it hits oxygen, it just vanishes and disappears. Mm-hmm. It's gone. Mm-hmm. You won't forget mm-hmm. this record again. And like it or not, Pink Floyd were trying to do that. It's a bit like Metal Machine music. That's mm-hmm. what they wanted to do. I mean, I think even they admit they didn't really succeed, which no. I think is where it is different to Metal Machine music. Mm-hmm. I don't really think, well, I actually said they didn't know what they wanted. I mean, maybe that's the thing. I'm not even sure they definitely knew definitely what they did want to do, but they certainly knew that they were, you know, they were going in to do something experimental and to just let whatever happened be the thing that happens. And certainly I think you've got a song like Astronomy Domine, which is the first song on Piper at the Gates at Dawn, which is a good record. And it's not the best version of it, and it does sound super dated at the time, but for 1969 standards, doing a live album, I don't think you can shit on it too much. It's 60s psychedelica is hard work, man. It's fucking hard work. And it's hit and miss. It's so hit and miss. But and even when this is hit and miss.
More miss than hit, personally.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I think it is more miss than hit, but I don't think there's anything on The Enemy or Dirty Vegas that could even be considered vaguely hit based. And particularly when their standards are so low. With yeah. what they're aiming for yeah. is so shooting fish in a barrel. Okay. I think that is more risible than what Pink Floyd are trying to do.
You've convinced me there, but how about we compromise and put it between The Enemy and Limp Bizkit?
Okay. Yeah, because it's not great, you know.
No, that's a fair compromise, though, I think.
Yeah, that's fine.
Oh, he's not happy. He's not happy.
No, it's fine. I think that's, you know, look, this is not a good... Look, to be honest with you, right... I didn't listen to this album until about 6 years ago.
Right.
Because there's a lot of Pink Floyd, like a bit with Nightmare Center and Napalm Death, what a daunting back catalogue. And particularly kind of the 60s and earlier stuff, I find that particularly daunting. And I think Piper at the Gates of Dawn was actually the second or third, yeah, because it would have been The Wall and then Dark Side of the Moon. And then I got Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and that's when I shit myself. And then I got Metal. That's when I got Metal, and I went, okay, there's definitely, like, it's different, but it's something else, but it's still good. Piper at the Gates of Dawn just weirded me out a lot. Mm-hmm. And then I just was like, I might leave that stuff for a while, and I just went for sort of all of the big ones. Mm-hmm. But when I came back to it, which was, you know, like I say, not long ago, because I was like, I never really did go fully in on that proper early part of Pink Floyd's career. Not very much of it has stuck with me. And Umma Gumma was certainly one of the ones that did not stick with me. Yeah. So, you know, I'm not here repping for it.
No, fair.
But it's not great. But in it goes, Umma Gumma by Pink Floyd. If you are one of those people that Renfrey's talking about and you're furious, please direct your anger to Renfrey and not to me, because I'm more on your side than he is. Well, certainly than he is. Anyway, yes, let's pick another house.
Always nice to hear from people who disagree with me.
Yeah. I said let's pick another house out. That's not true at all. Let's pick another album out of the hat. Ooh.
He's been playing Monopoly this entire time, ladies and gents.
Yes. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, original soundtrack by various artists.
Interesting. Okay.
So another bit, a couple of big Van Halen, yeah. Pink Floyd, and now the Beatles.
It's not the Beatles, but yes.
The Bee Gees.
Oh, the Bee Gees. Like, fuck me. Okay.
Hey, nothing wrong with the Bee Gees.
No, but I can't imagine them doing Sgt. Pepper era Beatles does not sound good to me.
That'd be good. Okay, cool.
Lonely Hearts Club Band. Yeah,
so no, that should be good. No. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, original soundtrack, is going to go into Broken Records next week. Okay, there you go. That is Pink Floyd's Umma Gumma in the list for Broken Records. Our next episode is the first episode recorded as Broken Records as its own separate podcast. So it won't be something that's getting thrown back to a previous episode of Riot Act. It will be its own thing from now on. So if you've just sort of found the podcast and you're like, what is going on where they keep throwing back to the, why are you doing that? Like, what is, basically, it used to be a segment, we're giving it its own thing. And from now on, its own thing it will be. So next time, starting off the episodes in full as, you know, as nature intended, Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band original soundtrack. That is there waiting for you to be listened to right now. It's the first kind of proper episode of it. I love this episode, yeah, by the way. I couldn't be happier that this was the one that came out as the first one that we did. I could not be fucking happier.
It's a great one. It's a great one to relaunch with, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. So enjoy that. As I said, go over to us on patreon.com/RiotActPodcast if you want to sign up for more exclusive content. There's some more Pink Floyd stuff over there. If you're a Pink Floyd fan, that's how you found this podcast. And you can listen to us reviewing all kinds of things from alternative music on Riot Act every Friday. But for now, we'll leave you and we'll suggest that you go over to Sergeant Pepper's and listen to that, because that sure is something.
Yes, it is.